Welcome.
It's my pleasure to introduce Dan Bogart O'Brien. Daniel actually grew up in a bar, pub, Irish, by the way, which means that it was, you know, better than average. They all wished they were Norwegians. And they came fairly close. Daniel, I first met him when he was chaplain, United Church chaplain at the University of Alberta North Campus, and appreciated almost immediately two things. One was that as a United Church clergyman, he had a lovely sense of the liturgical life and what it meant to gather people around and to invite them into contemplative and prayerful consideration of our life together in the world. The second part of Daniel's ministry that I gained a lot of appreciation for was his sense of the role he could play as a chaplain at the university in inviting the university to reflect on the great questions of life. In a sense, he did not see himself simply as a servant of the church, but saw the church as a servant of the intellectual life and the life of the world. So that was lovely to see, and I have lovely memories of that with Daniel. He went on and did his PhD in the education department at the University of Alberta, studying with a wonderful professor, having had lovely professors in his theological education, in his graduate work at Claremont College. Were you at Claremont as well?
No. We're almost neighbors.
Almost neighbors in the United States. Did his doctoral dissertation, that's the time that I knew Dan, looking at a couple of intellectuals who have, and wonderful people who have touched my life as well, both Thomas Merton as well as Ivan Illich. And Dan has then gone on to serve a number of churches and to teach in a variety of settings, initially at the University of Alberta a bit, as well as various other places in North America. He currently is serving a church in Surrey. That's not the one with the fringe on top, but the other Surrey near Vancouver, as I recall. Not the Christmas Carol. Is it a Christmas Carol?
Right.
Or whatever that song is. So I'm delighted you're here.
It's a musical.
Yeah, maybe. I'm delighted you're here and that you're going to speak to us tonight and engage in a conversation on the matters you're going to open up. Welcome.
Thank you, David. I don't preach from pulpits, so it's a little unusual for me to be reading a text from a pulpit. And I don't usually read from texts except privately. So it's a little strange to be trying to read a text with my eyesight. But it's also the reason why I want to read you this text is because it was an attempt. The Wesleyan quadrilateral is a really important thing to know about. There are four ways in which we learn. One of the ways is through our experience, our shared experience. One of the ways is through reason. One of the ways in terms of the church's life is through text, through scripture. And the other way I wanted to throw into that is the community life. That's the other way in which we learn. And then, of course, it's always hard for a United Church clergy to talk about tradition, but tradition is a part of that as well. But this text is why I want to read it, is because it is wrestling with an experience that I do not understand fully, and I hope I never understand fully, because that would denude the experience. The experience is more than can be understood. It's an experience. It's an experience that was in an odd way quite dark and quite wounding to me. But it opened me to one First Nations community. The important thing to really get hold of here is that it is First Nations. There's a plural. We often say Indians, and we think that all Indians are the same. All nations were the same. All spiritual traditions were the same. They were not. They were conflicting, often, traditions. One of the mistakes my wonderful church did was they sent their first ordained First Nations person, who happened to be Haida, to Kitimat. The Kitimat people did not talk to him for 2 years because he was Haida. The Haida, of course, came down the coast and burnt and took slaves back up to Haida. Sometimes we don't grasp the differences. So this is only one people's understanding, and it's not all people's understanding. And it is a people's understanding of the place in which they are, and it's a people's understanding of what it is to be human, which we were contemplating on just a few moments ago. It's dangerous for a mamakni, for a person who lives all the time on boats. All of us, I think, in this room are. There's some Métis people here and some First Nations people here. Those of us who are mamakni are always on boats and we never get to the land. It's dangerous for a mamakni to talk about these traditions. The big danger for me is Rousseau's big mistake, the noble savage, the romanticization of First Nations peoples. The other danger for me, if you can call it a danger, is the deep level of love that happened in that village, not simply my love, but their love and care for me, which was profound. A very broken village, but a village that incarnated love in all they did, except for Friday and Saturday night. First, a quote from Thomas Merton. It's from his book on Gandhi and the One-Eyed Giant. And excuse the use of the word man, but it is what Merton uses. The white man came into America like a one-eyed giant, bringing with him the characteristic split and blindness, which were at once his strength, his torment, and his ruin. With his self-isolated and self-scrutinizing individual mind, Western man was master of concepts and abstractions. He was the king of quantity and the driver of those forces over which quantitative knowledge gave him supremacy without understanding. The one-eyed giant had science without wisdom, and he broke in upon ancient civilizations that had wisdom, like the medieval West, without science. Wisdom which transcends and unites, wisdom which dwells in body and soul together, and which more by means of myth, of rite, of contemplation, than by scientific experiment opens the door to a life in which the individual is not lost in the cosmos and in society, but found in them. Probably a number of you love William Blake. Just to read you a bit of Blake. "Now I a fourfold vision see, and a fourfold vision is given to me. 'Tis fourfold in my supreme delight, and threefold in soft Belula's night, and twofold always may God us keep from single vision and Newton's sleep." If there is any doubt that the First Nations peoples of North America had a developed and complex civilization before contact with Western European immigrants, then one should attend a West Coast potlatch. These celebrative liturgies are rich and filled with multiple layers of mythic, political, and social meaning. They hold together the mythos and the ethos, the deep significance of human experience in a particular place and community. The rites and ceremonies are filled with moments of contemplation, spiritual, ethical, and political formation, disciplined artistry, pathos, joyful exaltation, and social integration. It was one Sunday morning. My hold on the liturgy and my Protestant church, a technical device in the context of a sacral culture, was finally broken by the gratuitous presence of the sacred. It was James, the holy fool, and James, indeed, in the potlatch, always danced the holy fool, always was the holy fool, along with David Frank, who is the other holy fool. He was my elder, my teaching elder. And he entered the church. He always was there. He was lighting the very inefficient wood stove that sat by the door. The door never closed. The dogs were usually in there as well. And James was always there first. And he looked at me that morning. I was nervously, as I was always nervously, preparing to exercise my learned technique of doing the Eucharist. It was a technological event with little meaning. The village, isolated as it had been from the full impact of the technological culture that surrounded it, was still a culture of sacrality and celebration, a community that lived, as Jack Godbout would have it, in the world of the gift. This world is one of informal social connection through the invisible ties of skills and cares shared, hands and words linked in a pattern beyond the human economy. It remained a potlatch society, despite the ravages of contact with the one-eyed giant of a modernity of formal, technical, and mercantile associations. It remained a culture defined by the gift given and received. The last week had been marked by a potlatch of significance beyond those celebrated in the recent history of the village. Nine guys had gone out with Cosmos aboard his, we used to call it a tippy, about 30 feet long, 35 feet long, troller, and they had gone up an inlet to plant trees, which was one of the occupations that many of the younger guys in the village did, and they'd gone up to plant trees, and Cosmos was a good skipper and a great man in a lot of ways, but he had not counted on the weather turning. The head of the inlet had an island which protected the bottom of the inlet from really knowing what was going on the other side of that little island. They got around the side of the island. It was blowing. The elders say they have never seen a storm like it. It was blowing the tops off of the breakers. It was blowing the tops off. It was blowing, they estimate, about 100, something like that. He turned. Wave hit the boat. It turned over. nine guys were there, and if you know anything about tree planting, usually you have gumboots on and rain gear. And what happened, of course, is seven of them were able to get the gumboots off. Two of them did not get the gumboots off and were swept probably to Japan. Who knows where their bodies were. We took about 3 or 4 days of circling in a herring punt to try and find their bodies. And that whole week afterwards was a week of potlatch. It was a week of mourning. And it was a week when the first time in, the elders were telling me, the first time in about 50 years that the wolves had come out. And the wolves, how do I explain the wolves? I'll talk about that later, but the wolves were the disciplining spirit of the natural order. Those who called human beings back into the rhythm of the natural order because they had wandered away from that rhythm. And they had never come out, as I said, for 50 years. I now have lost my place in my script and added another half hour as I remember things. That potlatch began with the usual dances and rituals. The usual dances and rituals were often dances and rituals held by the chiefs and held by other families and passed on to the next generation. The drummer's circle vibrated in the human bodies that sat on the benches along the sides of the hall. The chief's thunderbird dance flashed in the black and red of the cedar headdress and cape. The eagle down, which comes up off of the mask, was drifting about and onto the top of our heads and across us. The power and the grace of the dancers. A princess training in the law at University of Victoria, a young chief's son fishing in his father's 30-foot troller, were sign of their ascesis, their disciplined and deeply contemplative art. Their powerful legs sprang up from half crouch and back again with arms, wing-light, whirling capes, a strong and fluent witness to the spirit and wisdom of this community of ocean and mountains. And then the clowns. 85-year-old David Frank, 80-year-old James Adams, that took the floor, brought to the solemnity of the sacred Thunderbird dancers a comic yet crucial counterpoint. Their mimicry and exaggerations were raucous, raven replies to the majesty of the Thunderbird and Eagle. Theirs was a commentary on the hubris hidden even in the most sacred dances and rites. They came to remind the community that no technique or plan could ever capture or control the spiritual powers of the natural world. Holy fools teach us to laugh at our attempts to calculate the circumference of the sacred world. With laughter, these two opened both of my European eyes to see the dark and shadowed ways of the spirit in flesh. Ravens show in all their ingenious plans and inventions the unpredictable gifts of life. Raven shows all actions, calculated or uncalculated, bring the unforeseen and deepen mystery. James's teasing hip twists and David's taunting feather flaps release the hall from despair into a world of hope beyond expectation. The human ethos is rooted in a mythos, a sacred dance and story that opens up upon a reality that contains humanity, but itself cannot be contained. The boisterous hip thrusts and mocking feather flips exposed the pretenses and hubris of this European cleric, that fisherman, that band administrator, that elder, that commoner, that chief, and that shaman alike. We do not hold the keys to sacred powers. We may dance the steps of wisdom or participate in the sacred dance of the spirits, but we can neither control nor own the spirits. We can either make room for them in our hearts or harden our souls. All of this I had come to expect in the potlatch. However, I was unprepared for the coming crisis in my single-eyed vision that the entrance of the wolves would bring. Their entrance was marked by the ceasing of any sound or movement in the crowded hall. The video camera, an instrument allowed as a tool recorded for future generations. Even the most sacred dances of the killer whale and thunderbird were videotaped. It was turned off. In fact, all electronic mechanical devices were switched off and the lights were blacked out. In the darkness of the hall, a vibration thrummed in the corrugated steel walls, and the air was filled with sparks of lightning and a low howling. The digital god Kronos no longer governed, but his mother, Kairos, now danced in all the fullness of her dark body. Origins met endings. Earth met sea, sky, and all the elements took up the beat of drum and heart. The world of my professional techniques, my technologies, and the regulations that I obeyed was exposed as a distortion, a fabrication, and a distracting game. The power of the wolf entered, a wild yet disciplined art. I understood, perhaps I didn't, that what Rudolf Otto reclaimed of the word awe in the presence of the mysterium tremendum. The blurring of my single vision came as Blake's fourfold vision was given me. The technically ordered and calculated world in which I could make room for the potlatch as a museum piece or an interesting artifact to be examined and classified, it collapsed in that night with the disappearance of the seven who survived with the wolves. Taken in order that a balance might return to the cosmos, in that night, I lost my grip on the world, only to find myself within a larger and sacred epiphanous dance. Save for a few closing remarks, we quietly moved to our homes to wait. No lahal was played, no gifts distributed. As on Good Friday, the gathered community simply left into the darkness to seek hope without expectation. Saturday passed as a vigil. Children asked where fathers and grandfathers had disappeared to, but no answers were spoken. Sunday's dawn broke, an early spring sun warming the rocks and our hopes. I entered an empty church, save for James, and without words, he took me to the sacred shore. The world of the gift was in the surf breaking and the invisible dance of dark and light, spirit and form gathered on the shore. Thomas Merton writes, "It is true that neither the ancient wisdoms nor the modern sciences are complete in themselves. They do not stand alone. They call for one another. Without wisdom, science is unable to penetrate the full sapiential meaning of the created and material cosmos. And science without wisdom leaves man enslaved to a world of unrelated objects in which there is no way of discovering order or deep significance. My time in the potlatch societies of the West Coast brought me to confusion about the tradition and science I carried in my one-eyed dance on the earth. Though I never felt I represented very well this one-eyed giant of Western religion and thought, my vision was clearly handicapped by its monitored vision. As my wife and I were initiated into the potlatch dances, we began to see into a world of primordial depth and ineffable, yet relational power. The highly rational, exegetical and juridical religious pattern I was trained in at seminary and by my religious order as an ordained United Church cleric was able to accept indigenization as an interesting ethnic feature and a politically important advance. The adding of local color and custom was an addition that required no profound change in awareness and no disturbance of the soul. Merton writes, if we want to bring together what is divided, we cannot do so by imposing one division upon the other or absorbing one division into the other. But if we do this, the union, in Merton's words, it's not Christian. It is political and doomed to further conflict. We must contain all divided worlds in ourselves and transcend it. Indigenization was then and is still, I would argue, a political agenda item in the larger project of absorbing First Nations peoples into the institutional forms of the church and European society. It is a project defined by the texts and projects of Western ideology. The technique of the gospel of liberation and the devices of salvation that I learned so well are applications, are apps, intended to erase the other in a culturally sensitive manner, murdering softly and subtly by reducing difference to an exchange of artifacts and signs. This is the imposition of one division upon the other. It is a political move made to reduce the other to a set of signs. Signs are exchangeable. Symbols and living communities are not. In the politics of indigenization, the divided worlds are not allowed to enter into ourselves. Rather, they are colonized by the institution as signs of an inclusion. The political tactic of indigenization is a way that dominant culture uses to expunge guilt and maintain control of the other. The constructed self, the self as defined by a pattern of consumption and fabrication, is not transcended. Merton exposed, as the experience of the wolves exposed to me, the deep division within this constructed self. The crucifixion of this self came in my confusion and deep sense of disorientation and loss. Unless I was prepared to sacrifice my will to power, attend completely to the truth of the other without attempting to control the outcome, I was merely making a political move and ensuring further violence and conflict. But the profound consequences of emptying out the constructed self, of deconstructing all that I had counted as gain, as loss, came as the terrifying grace of encounter with spirits unmapped by my theology. The world of the gift, God boot again, exposed my retreat from the deep engagement of gifts. On encountering the world of potlatch, its spiritual relatedness and depth, my vision was blurred by dimensions my single-eyed training had prepared me against but could not prevent.
My gaze, having lost confidence in the penetrating technical power of a prescriptive theology, could no longer define the edges of things. All reality seemed involved in a dance that moved through and beyond sight and analysis. No longer able to gaze upon the world with a sharp clarity of the devices of technique, I found myself losing faith in the technical power of my theology. I lost confidence in the constructs and suffered a fundamental loss of faith in the religious systems I carried. I tasted a chaotic shifting of forms that were half exposed and half in shadow. I fell into a wild sea of relational and sacred intensity beyond the discursive genius of my Protestant thesis. I entered a time of mental and spiritual crisis. The obsessive technical precision, the theological certitudes I once proclaimed, seemed in this world to be a form of mental derangement. The apophatic sanity and discipline of the wolves made the clarity of my liberation theology, my Christian Marxism, appear to be but the manic episode of a bipolar consciousness. When I voyaged back into the order of shopping malls and city grids, this personally felt derangement appeared to be the rule of an entire culture. Again, Merton writes, the split of the European mind has become universal. All are caught in the fundamental division between deliberate, frantic activity organized by the lifeless abstractions, techniques, and ideologies, static concepts, and the instinctive and spontaneous life. It is a crisis of sanity, first of all. The problems of the nations are the problems of mentally deranged people, but magnified 1,000 times because they have the full, straight-faced approbation of a schizoid society, schizoid national structures, schizoid military and business complexes, and need one add, schizoid religious sects. We are at war with ourselves, said Kumaraswamy, and therefore at war with one another. Western, I'll use the word people, he doesn't, is and are unbalanced. These words, Merton uses in an introduction to a collection of Gandhi's writings on nonviolence, and they speak directly to my lived experience as a young cleric in a potlatch society. My sapiential eye and that of contemporary Western persons is occluded, closed, and distracted by technical processes and devices. The culture of technology, what I have chosen to call this bipolar structure of contemporary Euro-American experience, is the hyper-reality of those shaped by the video monitor, the rituals of consumption, the manipulations of text and hypertext, and the isolation of the mind from the complexity and reality of embodied interdependence. It is, excuse my making up of a word, it is a technostic mythos that has reduced the ethos, place, and community to an artifice, a scenario, and a packaged and packageable flow of information. The danger is that deficiencies in the model of this technological culture are taken as opportunities for its expansion into and therefore trivializing of all areas of human experience. Merton knows the worst thing that can happen to a person who is already divided up into a dozen different compartments is to seal off yet another compartment and tell him or her that this one is more important than all the others. This was my dilemma, and is, I argue, the dilemma we face in this current dysfunctional phase of our culture, expressed equally in our theologies and in our patterns of life. Such was, and still is, my impulse to fix the disease, to manage the fool's dance, to tame the wolves, and find a better technique to bring salvation to the earth. The single-eyed giant of modernity, when confronted with the evidence of its own inadequacies, rather than coming down to earth and the dark realities of interdependence, develops yet more devices and self-help programs and bodybuilding techniques and extracurricular activities and software apps and programs and applications. The half-blind giant, like Abby Yo-Yo, if you know Pete Seeger's song, plays with its own shadow, fed to it by its own devices, dancing to an onanistic beat of a drum machine. Hopefully, like the fabled giant, it will fall to the ground, exhausted from its own self-obsessed and frantic capering, to make an identity and to leave a mark. The techniques, the plans, and the managed response of the one-eyed giant may lose their grip on us, and we might, face flat on the earth, taste our dependence on the gift, our vulnerability to the infinite order of interdependence. Again, my teacher, Merton, writes, "From what has been said, it is clear that there is and can be no special planned technique for discovering and awakening one's inner self, because the inner self is first of all a spontaneity that is nothing if not free. Therefore, there is no sense in starting with a definition, then deducing its essential properties, and then some appropriate and infallible means of submitting it to control." Merton is aware of the great danger he faces in speaking in a culture of technology of the free gift of human experience. The contemplative ascesis is certainly a disciplined art, but its discipline is not a technique or an attempt to control or reduce or project a self. The fictitious character occupied in very active self-impersonation uses the cover of authenticity or uniqueness, or the other good one, reflection, to keep away the reality of incompletion, of dependence, and of the mystery of the gift of human being. The technical eye may cultivate the contemplative look that seems appropriate to him or her, and that fashionably she or he likes to see in him or herself. And the fact that his busy narcissistic turn is turned within and feeds upon itself in stillness and secret love will make him or her believe that his or her experience of themselves is an experience of God. But this I of projects, technical expertise, efficient prayers, and long phylacteries makes the otherness and relational touch of inner and outer experience into a series of manipulable objects. This is the eye of a gaze that monitors, scans, and digitally renders, but never touches the face of the other within the self or in the relational world. This is not the true self that comes as a gift in the dark night. The myth of the culture of technology is precisely this. The world is made up of data, the manufacture, manipulation, and consumption of objects that only accidentally have a relationship to each other. The relational order, as secondary, can be infinitely manipulated and rendered by technical processes. Everything can be mapped, calculated, and displayed as bits of information while being infinitely plastic. The technostic creed holds that the greater technical proficiency at storing and manipulating data is equivalent to human enlightenment and progress. It promotes the universal myth that technology infallibly makes everything in every way better for everybody. Vodka would be better. By contrast, the true self, the self given as a divine gift, is a dark shadow that none of the obtrusive light of technique can illumine. The ascesis, the discipline of this dark self, is one of preparation for surprise and not against it, openness to wonder and not fabrication of complex devices, and hospitality to the other as a relational and substantive fact. The other and the true self cannot be manipulated because they remain beyond analysis. They are the dark gift of unknowing. Merton's contemplative life was a challenge to all attempts to control or reduce the self, the other, and creation to essential properties that are objects for our manipulation and for the manipulation of our devices. The true nature of self and of creation is not as object, but as experienced other. Contemplation and inner solitude are the ascesis for Merton of a hospitality to this other. This is a stripping away of all social constructions and technical projections, unencumbered by technique and manufactured desires. The contemplative comes to a presence that eludes all technique by an absence of possession. The joy of being embraced by this absence is the joy of being free of all need in the presence of the inestimable favor of reminding us of our true capacity for maturity, liberty, and peace. We suffer all the needs that society demands we suffer, because if we do not have these needs, we lose our usefulness in society. And that is the usefulness, as Merton writes, of suckers. We fear to be alone and to be ourselves, and so to remind others of the truth that is in them. The culture of technology is one that defines humanity according to an endless and plastic set of expectations that it creates and then seeks to satisfy. By satisfying only expectations, the culture of technology brackets, ignores, or attempts to factor in as a piece of data the face of the other. The technical device, unlike the simple tools, does not remind the user of the limit and relational realities of human life. Rather, the technical device locks the user into an ever-expanding consumption of improved technical devices and processes, and convinces the user of the never-ending need of more technical devices and processes to solve the problems created by the earlier generation of technical devices and processes. The sucker is us, as Merton describes. By trying to find a final solution, does that ring some bells? A final solution to human contingency and dependence on others is caught in an ever-expanding complexity of devices that evade the fact, the reality, of our human interdependence and our rootedness in the gift of life. By contrast, the use of focal practice, this is a term by Albert Borgman, the book is probably in your bookstore. Go out and buy it now, and we'll meet in another half hour after you've read the book. But Borgman needs to be read. But Borgman gives you this concept of a focal practice over against a device orientation. A focal practice or a focal thing, tools, art pieces, icons, they do not hide the limitations or the complexity and mysterious relational webbing that touches and supports both the inner and outer life. Craft and tool, the artful work of hands and minds, can awaken the self to the commonwealth of God's creation. In Borgman's observations about the true self and Merton's observations about the true self, contemplation and technology, Merton does not clarify the distinction between focal practice, tools, craft, and the culture of technology. The mythology of the one-eyed giant is a story of the reduction of religion and science to technical processes. It is also the history of the social construction and economic manufacturing of desire. Merton often suggests that technology is merely the making of more sophisticated tools, or that science is equivalent to technology. But technology is a culture with a mythos, a myth, an artificial ethos, and a utilitarian ethics. By contrast, science, from its origin in Greek and classical thought, was an askesis, an artful discipline attempting to give understanding to the patterns of the natural order. Science of this sort increases wonder, while the culture of technology increases self-deception. The culture of technology is the cult of a Gnostic belief in a technique for abstracting the logos, meaning, and ascending by the force of will from the sarx, the flesh, contingent reality. Craft as focal practice, the thoughtful engagement of hands in the fashioning of a thing or working the soil, a thing of beauty and inner and outer clarity, like my example is the Shaker furniture that Merton so admired, is an icon of the mysteries of creation. Craft, David, this is dangerous. Craft is the word becoming flesh. Craft is the word becoming flesh. While the potlatch is not John's gospel or the contemplative prayer of Merton, it is an affirmation of the spirit as gift in flesh, of the impossibility of severing the mystery of unity in the gift without self-deception. The focal practices and tools of the contemplative Trappist and the tools and practices of the potlatch society give clarity and cut through deception. Such examples may give a clearer understanding of the place of tools and practices that open the self to the relational depth of the sacred's presence in creation. Such a clarity of distinctions between tool, focal practice, and technological processes and devices is not to give in to the reductive, but to offer an insight into the gift in a time, I use the expression, of technological barbarism. God, I set off an alarm. The use and crafting of tools and the quantitative disciplines were intended to fit and find the place of humanity within the created order. The hoe was crafted as an implement fitting the hand to work the soil. And while removing weeds from the farmer's fields, it was not intended to simplify creation by removing the weed from the face of the earth. The ascesis of science was intended to open the eye from single vision to dimensions beyond sight. Science as practiced by an Albert Einstein or a Barbara McClintock begins and ends in wonder at a pattern that engages the self. The monastic orders of the day were intended as a way of opening the self from delusion to the gift of being. Through a disciplined yet graceful movement of tools and practices of contemplative awareness, fitting labor and practiced observation, insight comes of a relational pattern and a holy presence beyond the capacities of these disciplines to describe. Technology, the culture or logos of technique, identified long ago by Jesus when he pointed to the devout who measured their spiritual worth by the length of their phylacteries and the quantity of their prayers, is a different thing than ascesis, science, art, or craft. The culture of technology is the celebration of and loyalty to techniques, devices, and processes as the salvation of humanity. The ascesis that Jesus counseled and practiced, the science of his science, and the art of his art, if you will, was his divine capacity to see the truth and beauty of people and things, and therefore thereby to bring them to the health of knowing their place, the relational home in the divine commonwealth. This is a reception of and an affection for the world in all the fullness and depth of its subsisting relationships. Necessary focal practices are where the fitting tool, the needed skill, the beautiful art of hand, the dance or hymn, open the self to a gift already present. The radical hospitality of Jesus' table fellowship, of his healings, of his teaching, and of his very being are invitations to recover the full and true relational self from captivity by techniques and oppressive social patterns. I'm going to use two words here, and I hope you understand them. The ratio, the discursive capacity of the human mind and hand to search and research, to skillfully develop and use tools, is not abandoned for an abstracted intellectus. Rather, the ratio, as Aquinas noted, is a prosthetic aid, a tool to bring the self to the intellectus. This intellectus is what Heraclitus called a listening into the being of things. Joseph Pieper notes that not only the Greeks, Aristotle no less than Plato, but the great medieval thinkers as well held the path of discursive reason is accompanied and penetrated by the intellectus, untiring vision, which is not active, not truly passive, rather it's receptive, a receptivity operating in the intellect and in the being. Merton offers an invitation into the life of the intellectus as a disciplined attending to the true self. His resistance to the digitized single vision of modernity, the violence of its institutional processes, and its blindness to the depth of human relationality in place and in community propelled him into solitude. The ethos of monastic solitude is in the depths of the gift it finds in its particular place. The work of prayer and hands, by being fitting to that particular place and human being, empty out the self to a unity with holy being. By contrast, the culture of technology is a metaphysical construct that creates a mythos disconnected from the relational complexity and the human ethos of living in the household of holy being. Therefore, its ethics are ones of the straight-faced approbation of a schizoid society, the self-deception of division. For Merton, this is the insanity of the collective commitment to technology as it commodifies, programs, and manufactures human selves, desires, and a world. In a talk Merton gave to his novices in June of 1966, he jokingly suggests, "What the hell do I know about technology? I get into that bloody steel building over there and I'm lost," referring to a new building constructed at the Abbey. But in other places, notably in his comments near the end of his life, as in the essay quoted above from Gandhi on nonviolence, he speaks of technological civilization as a cult of technical power that has replaced divine messengers with machines, creating a crisis of sanity. In an article written for a short-lived Dominican journal in 1967, a year before his death, entitled "The Angel and the Machine," Merton writes, "We meet the angels, the messengers of divine help. For me, the wolves on that night long ago, on the frontiers of our own freedom and our own capacity. They touch us when we reach our natural limits. This is why to us they are terrible, not only because they are greater than we, not only because they belong to the sacred world of the totally other, but because we do not usually meet them except when we ourselves are at the end of our strength, our endurance, and our understanding, or of our capacity to hope and to believe. The angel appears when we ourselves are reduced to the center of our deepest need. When we have come to face the reality of our own deepest need, our dependence on powers beyond ourselves, the face of the sacred messenger appears. In order to curtail this, to prevent the recognition of the deepest need, we create mechanisms and processes, artificial environments, abstracted from the reality of the mystery of our contingency. This culture of technology insists it is human progress, a distancing from the fact of our dependence. The machine, the technical process, and the managed program have replaced the divine messenger. Merton writes, technological civilization is, as we have it now, a civilization without angels. It is a civilization in which we have chosen the machine instead of the angel. That is, we have placed the machine where the angel used to be, at the limit of our own strength, at the frontier of our own capacity. But now we can view our limits without fear and without the need of invisible helpers. The machine is fully visible, and though the world of machines is itself something of a mysterious tremendum, it becomes more so with computers, incidentally, yet the machines are now our angels. We made them, not they themselves. They are, we think, entirely in our own power. They become then extensions of our own intelligence, our own strength. We do not have to walk to the edge of an infinite void in order to feel the brush of their unpredictable wings upon us in the starlight. They form part of our own enclosed and comfortable world. They stand between us and nature. They form a kind of room in which we are isolated from the rest of creation, and therefore all the more from spiritual beings. As we live in the small room, as I lived in my small room of my own making, we become more isolated from the reality of our physical dependence and our contingency. It is not the case that the technical devices, the walls, the floor, and ceilings of the room escape these realities. Rather, they disguise them. They hide them from sight, and can prevent the visceral feel of them from entering into our imagination. The face of the other, mediated by the screen, can avoid touching us or demanding from us a recognition of a shared physical reality. I picked up the telephone one day in my office when I was proud, very proud that day. I was the first chaplain at the University of Alberta to have a computer on my desk. It was an 086. It had no memory. It could print one page of text, and then it crashed. I was so proud. I had the technological device to overcome all of the distance that I felt between me and every member of the universe. One day, the telephone rang. A voice of someone who needed to hear me talk and needed to exchange in human intercourse, something I was beginning to not know anything about, heard click, 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 and said, what the hell are you doing? And I said, I'm looking at my computer screen, and hung up. The extension of our physical power and magnification of the dispersive calculations of our mind has meant the atrophying of the human capacity to feel reverence for the other, human, non-human, or divine, and to know the inescapable reality of our relatedness to these others. We once knew, fearfully perhaps, and never completely, by sheer contact, that our being, our self, was a place of conversation, of feeling the touch and breath of others. The great commandment, the law of Moses, Plato's dialectic of the same and other, all witness to a world of human experience in which we knew ourselves by living in an ethos of others and the same, in a mythos of spirits and divinity that touched and walked with us. Narcissus was recognized as deranged by his self-obsession. Today, we live in a culture that encourages such derangement, widens and extends self-absorption and obsession into all realms of human life. Mechanism and process replace human contact. We construct a self from and as a monitored image and reality in the flow of data and objects used and consumed in the maintaining of images. Lee Hochnacki, who was a close friend of Illich, in the report of his Camino, his pilgrim walk to Compostela in Spain, writes, "Today's irrational beliefs, however, are usually lacking any sensible ground or foundation. They point to abstract, oftentimes arbitrary constructs or fantasies, such as GNP, insurance systems, technological solutions. The people who walked to Compostela in years past could see and touch the sacred objects that remained from the lives of people who manifestly reached heroic heights of virtue. The angels have receded from our awareness, not because we have become more earthly, more attached to the world. Rather, our technological skill and shell has grown so thick we have lost contact with the earth except as a commodity or a piece of data to be calculated or processed. The rain is no longer the rain or the soil the soil. They are natural resources." We should talk about that expression. "The friend is no longer the friend. She is a node in a network. The sacred, risky, wondrous, awe-filled world has receded to become a background, a landscape, and I confess, for me, a screensaver for my laptop. It's not merely that we try to live in a community of human definition. That is a problem in and of itself. Rather, we more and more live in a collectivity marked by mechanical exchanges where our own face and the face of the human other only is pronounced real if it appears as an image in the show of our screens." I'm just about there. The mythos of the culture of technology is the mythos of apps, of applications. A world, in fact, of applications. The applications, the devices, the routines are the focus of attention, and the atrui, as Levinas called it, the other, are mere data to be manipulated, simulated, rendered by appliances and applications, software, hardware, programs, and techniques to the user. Application has replaced the risk and complexity of relationship and encounter with creation. The body has become a monitored body, only pronounced real because it has been recorded by some device. It is ineffable, physical reality, as the place of touching and meeting the other is replaced by the scan and readout. The risk, the mystery, the contingency of sheer physical engagement becomes a programmed performance. and the ineffability of death, the beauty and mystery of mortal flesh, becomes a failure of technique. James, my elder James, on that Sunday morning, took me by the hand, and he led me from the chapel that actually he had helped build. He could remember forming the arches of the roof. Incidentally, the chapel had no insulation, and it leaked all the time. And I finally found out because I went up and discovered that there was that space up there, and they told me it was going to be a good place for a smokehouse for fish, which was probably a better purpose than what I used it for. There, as the immense power of the open Pacific broke on the shore of this fragile community, all 500 souls in that village participated in a ritual of recovering our place in creation. It was a meeting with angels, the messengers of the sacred. Coiled on the gray sand of the beach was a rope that extended through the surf to a shoreline at the opposite end of the bay. The rope is a focal thing for fisher peoples of all races and clans. It is a tool of rescue, of securing fast to land or rock in storms. It is repaired with diligence. It is something that is made of human hands, weaving together many strands. The strands are stories and filaments of myth. The strands are life and death. The strands are ethos and mythos. All of us, old and young, and this Mamakni and my partner, another Mamakni, place the rope between our hands. And at a signal from the elders, we began to pull the rope, bringing the seven back into our lives and bringing balance back to the cosmos. Sea, land, human society, other and same, and the gift of flesh-held spirit were brought back into proper relationship. There on the sand of a million waves, the relationship and the gifts of rope, hands, and those dark angels of hope, the wolves, rescued human being back into the dark mystery of creation. And my vision could never be clarified of such distressing joy or the presence of such dark angels. As St. John of the Cross once wrote, O guiding night, O night more lovely than the dawn. Thank you. I'm not a fan of bottled water, but I needed it. Do we need to be in a circle? People feel comfortable conversing this way as long as you can touch each other's faces and see each other's eyes. Do you have a clean hand? I hope.
Sorry.
I know you probably don't. It's hard to explain the depth of that experience, which has pushed me off of all sorts of nice, comfortable, mechanical, theological answers to all problems. I went to the village, as I said, a Christian Marxist coming out of liberation theology. Not so bad. But I went there with the rather bizarre belief that as a Mamakni, as a Western Protestant cleric,
that I could actually save the village and bring them to full humanity. That's our problem. James Ever the Trickster grabbed me one day by hand. It was a bench that was in front of Edgar Charlie, who was a bit of a jerk. But anyway, Edgar Charlie's house. Edgar was one of the chiefs, and his display of his lack of care for others was pretty well exhibited in the village. But James grabbed me by the hand and sat me down and said, "Shut up and listen. In terms of your reflecting on the land and your reflecting on its meaning, and I would say its spirit, shut up and listen. It is damn good advice. But you have to be able to listen," was the trick I had to learn. Because the layer of the techniques that I had learned them pretty well. I actually was a very good theological student, not writing, unfortunately, meant to go on to PhD level. But the problem is I had learned theology as a set of techniques to explain the mystery rather than a set of tools and disciplines that would open me to know the mystery, to know what, you know, what this very small mind could possibly know, and then hopefully to respect the unknowing and to be with the unknowing. That's really hard for us, at least those of us who are Euro-Americans. But there's a man who knows all the answers.
I mean, this last comment of yours is really to what I was thinking about. I mean, you grew up with the myth. You grew up with a particular biblical Christian story that speaks about or speaks to the great questions of human life. It invites people to be present to those questions. And within the Christian tradition, there is an amazing body of dramas, certainly as amazing as the rope one that you described. What happened? Like, why the hell didn't you have access to it? How does it come about that gets colonized?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you've described the other part of the danger of colonization.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How did that get colonized?
I knew you were going to ask that question.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. We've been talking about it all day. I mean,
yeah.
Back and forth on it.
It's so amazing.
This is a hard, hard confession for me to make, because I was born into the mystery, into the story, received it in the cornrows from my father's lips, you know, received the mystery. But something happened in seminary. Seminary is a training in using technique and technological devices in the biggest term of that, you know, technology. In fact, the reason, this is, David, I mean, you've heard me say this, the reason I sought ordination rather than doing my PhD in teaching, which I love to do as well, was because of the mystery of the Eucharist. And yet, the mystery was pounded, not literally pounded out of me, by my classes in liturgical studies, my classes in worship, and even, you know, I love John Cobb, my mentor in terms of theology. I think he still had a sense of the mystery, but my attempt to intellectually move through the material that he was giving us, rich and profound as it was. However, the thing that I learned in the seminary was to apply a technique. Apply a technique. And not even to use the tools that were being offered to me. And I think here's the dangerous comment. I think that's unfortunately what the university is all about, is teaching technique. It's not teaching understanding or knowledge or wisdom or ultimately openness to mystery. It has a hard time with that. And yet I go, you know, I of course go back to Aristotle, Plato, I go back to the origins of the university, which I would argue was a place for seeing, experiencing, and perhaps knowing something of the mystery, but not of reducing it. Reducing it to something we can mold and something we can manipulate and something that becomes ultimately simply another technique. Too long an answer.
I ask this question as a current staff candidate of the United Church.
What's that church?
So no offense, no pressure, but you have to provide me some vocational hope in your response. I really like how you describe how seminary and ordination sort of produced and colonized the mystery for you. And so you stand here as the rest of the story. How do you unpractice, given this formative experience you had in the village, how... do you have another example of how you unpractice that in your current ministry or in your current work?
I'm trying real hard. But it's so pervasive. This won't help you.
Thanks for that.
This is a very bizarre response, and it's a bizarre response from a father who just received a phone call from my daughter this afternoon on my cell phone. It's not a smartphone, it's just a cell phone. I've developed in that way. And the way I commonly listen to voices on the cell phone is as abstractions. However, I have had to learn how to hear beyond the techniques and the technology a real presence. The only way I can say this, it is a form of contemplative attentiveness to those who are there and to the sacred in the sarx, the holy in the flesh. It is a form of attentiveness and discipline to attend to the other. The problem for us is, you can report me to the United Church of Canada. I'm not a happy camper in the United Church of Canada. The United Church of Canada was born, you know, in one way, it was simply born out of the practicalities of having a damn big country and all these, you know, three churches in a village of 200 or something. And finally, they said, what are we doing this for? But it was also born out of I would call it a utilitarian view of the gospel. It viewed the gospel as a technique and almost a technology to be applied to however we want to talk about salvation, to save, rather than as an entry point into the experience of the wonder and the mystery of the divine incarnate in flesh and blood. We're wedded to that. David, you've got the copy of the red book. He has a wonderful thing. He talks about the two twins, right? Yeah. Say more about that. It might help. I know nothing I said helps, but...
Well, if you think of the biblical narratives that in the last 100 years or so there have been two primary ways of reading those narratives. One is a kind of evangelical literalist way of reading them, and another is a liberal modernist way of reading them. So my argument is simply that both of these ways of reading were born from the 18th century, from the development of the Age of Reason. So the narratives were read through a prism of trying to understand what's historically real in these narratives. I mean, was Jesus really born of a virgin? Like, what does that possibly mean? Or was Jonah really swallowed by a big fish? So on the one side, you get one argument about it, on the other side, you get a different argument. But the issue, if we can just come back to you here, I think, is that this is a tragedy that it was read this way. Because if you read the Bible that way, and it makes no difference which side you're on, if you do that for 100 years, your grandkids are going to realize the text ain't worth listening to. Because you have robbed it and stripped it of its capacity to speak to the great, into the great questions of human life. Those stories aren't about history. They are, to use Daniel's term, about mythos. That is, they are about ultimate meaning. And they give you a landscape in which to consider. They help deepen your capacity to be present to your own experience about those matters and to open to them as opposed to have an answer. And of course, we've had preaching based on that. It's no wonder nobody goes to church. The clergy have convinced people it's religious.
Art sister still turns up.
I didn't really mean that. I was just to your point.
Well, I'd like to answer that question because it's also something I struggled with. I went to university because I really wanted to teach. Mm. I had this joy of wanting to be with people. Actually, I really wanted to continue learning. And I figured the only way I could continue learning is to become a teacher, because then I could stay in school all my life, where I thought learning always happened. But what I really loved to do was create. And so I became a home ec teacher. And when I was in university, I got right into it. I got all the technical, so good, tailoring and all the fabric techniques that by the time I finished, I couldn't create anything because I would look at something and know, you know, 20 different ways of creating something with a skill and it would never be perfect. And if you've ever met home ec teachers, perfection is, you either have two extreme experiences of home ec, you hate it because you had teachers, or you loved it because you got to cook and sew, you got to do something instead of sitting in a chair. And so I actually for about 4 years didn't create anything, and I finally got back to the joy of creating through the students, because those fresh grade sevens, Bob can attest when they got into my classroom, were so excited about being in a place where they could get hands-on what you talked about, that crafting, that exuberance of awe. This is what happens when, and I brought chemistry in, you know, like baking soda creates this because, and it just connected all these other subjects that they were learning in the abstract in a very practical way. And for the longest time, I didn't actually, ever since, I haven't created clothes. Before that, I would make things I would wear. Now, I create things from my soul that have no practical purpose except for beauty. And I think that's part of that. It's not an either or. I can now, because of that technical expertise, see any kind of created fabric and deconstructed into its shape so that I could recreate it in another way. And I also enjoy the technology. I can get a kit now that's been done computer-wise where I don't have to do all the technical stuff. So there, I think there's an integration here that we need to acknowledge, that the urge of, and I guess the foundation to that is to follow the urge of the creative. And not lose the sight of the very practical. So my question back to you is, what happened to the wolves? Like, I understand the mythology of what you were talking about, but the very practical, give me a sense of what the wolves are like in that place.
We couldn't hear the question.
What are the wolves like?
And what happened to them?
I confess I did recognize some of them because the lights came up eventually, but I think the role they played in the community, what they brought to the community, was a re-centering into the mystery of the rhythm of creation. The elders explained it to me as these are the spirits that we call to come to help us again to know the mystery of the created order. But also, I mean, the practical reality of that is how to live in that rhythm. I didn't understand that at all. The only time I got a glimpse of it was we were probably a bad ecological practice. I don't know. It's called Food Fishing Day, and the Department of Fisheries give the village usually is a couple days a year where they're allowed to hand seine. It was in the mouth of the Kennedy River, and I. Yeah, Loretta's going to phone any minute now. But my wife, if I make a promise in the hearing of this beloved human being who I love with all my soul and my body, if I make a promise to do something, to get up at 5 o'clock in the bloody morning and go fishing, she forced me out the door. Arriving on the boat, we fished and fished, and finally I was told, you in the boat. Because, oddly enough, they thought I was kind of a shaman-like figure and I might be able to find the fish by some practice that I had. I
went to the wrong seminary.
Yeah, totally wrong seminary. We cast the net. Sorry, I love telling stories but not answering questions. But we cast the net and got two fish. The second time, the elders sort of spoke to us and said, the fish really don't like, the salmon really don't like the way you're casting that net. You're not reaching out to them. You're not in touch with them. It's very practical. So try it again. Use the rhythm of the mystery of creation.
That's what Jesus said.
We cast the net, and 365 sockeye were, I was up to my knees in fish, terrified. Went to shore, broke open a few fish and roasted them over the fire. And the elders finally explained to me, you need to do things in your life that are in the rhythm of creation. And the fish will go, give it a break. I'm not getting in that net. But, that was a beautiful set. And that's how they understand the relationship between things. Doesn't answer. But I think the practicality of it is real. I'm a little nervous to use the word it's pragmatic, because that has a whole other sense of meaning for us, which is reductive. Their practicality is not, it probably is now. I'm talking about a period of time in the life of that village, and I'm lying. I'm lying if I don't say, you know, life in the village was incredibly destructive. They were incredibly destructive to each other. Yes, the dysfunctionality was related to the impact of one culture on another, and I see that the culture I represented was probably the one that created the dysfunctionality, but it was a real dysfunctionality. So it wasn't as if, you know, I'm not trying to give a Rousseauian, oh, they were, you know, perfect human beings, perfect harmony with the world because they actually were in touch with the mystery of the creator. No, that's a lie. But every once in a while, you know, every once in a while they plummet the depths. And it still was. I want to use the word, David, correct me, but I want to use it. I want to talk about it as a sacral culture, a culture of sacraments that saw almost everything as at the meeting place with the spirit. Sorry, I got to attend your home economics class.
Where are some of the places where you see our culture plunging into those depths?
Because
I think that we have it as well.
It's more fractured and more difficult. And the problem for us is the tendency to create of the spiritual disciplines, to create of them a technique that will guarantee. My son is an actor. Why am I picking on my kids? Because they love him. But my son on stage, I was just in tears, yes, because I love him and all that stuff, but also in tears because he had touched the sacred mystery of human presence. That's why he's such a great actor.
Art's got to go.
Sorry, I'm talking with my back to you, but the example I used the other day, and this may not make any sense either, I had a magnificent fight with the organist in my last church in Toronto. I lost the fight, but I usually lose fights because I'm pretty passive, but it was about her music, essentially. It wasn't music. It was technically perfect, but it wasn't music. It didn't touch on the mystery. I have listened to Glenn Gould's Goldberg Variations, and this is where the fight began. And I said, Glenn Gould, he's perfect. You know, every note is in the perfect, and he did it by splicing, incidentally, and putting it all together. But it's not music. I heard a young pianist at the National Arts Center play the Goldberg dared to play the Goldberg Variations. And I was touched with the mystery. The mystery was there. It's because she was not focused on the technique. She was entering the music itself. There are moments when I am speaking with my dear friends at Colebrook United Church when that happens. And it's when I actually forget there's a technique, there's a beginning and an end and all the, you know. And suddenly we are simply, the way I say it, we're simply there with each other's being. And I hope I do, anyway, I hope they do as well, sense the mystery. So it's not that we abandon technique, but we put technique in its place only as a tool that we can launch into the mystery. We're good at techniques, but that spiritual step of moving into the mystery of the land, of the place, of the people, is something that comes hard to us. There is a discipline to it, but I think the discipline, this is an odd thing to say, the discipline is emptying out of ourselves so that we can be present in the mystery.
think on that note, people can chat more if you have a bit of time after, but there's others who already have been good to have to travel quite a ways then. So we want to thank you for coming and for sharing, and hopefully we can actually have that. Is it possible to get the written version at some point? Or?
You can have it. See there.
We have it left now.
Yeah, I think it's on my Dell computer. I'll have to check. Yeah. I always forget there's that thing called save, isn't there?
Something like that. Yeah, that's a weird function. So, and thank you very much, because it gives an amazing large frame of what we're wrestling with in trying to get to the spirit of the land. Well, how do we do that when we're surrounded in a world of technique and technology? And people who make their livelihood, whether urban or in farming, basically through technology, it's very hard to then say, well, then how do we listen to, you know, whatever the land, the community, the people are telling us, and how do we respond to that? So thank you for stirring up that conversation for us and giving beautiful images for us to deal with that. Thanks so much.